coming up on Philosophy Talk. A philosophical look at the 2016 election.
Let's look beyond the horse race at some of the larger philosophical questions raised by this year's campaign.
Why vote at all?
It's really important, even if your vote doesn't change the outcome, that you contribute to this experience of mass participation.
Stanford political scientist Emily Chapman.
How do you justify the two-party system?
You have to choose some way to reflect people's preferences in a democratic system. And they all have their pluses and minuses.
Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution.
Can democracy survive the amount of money in our elections?
We have a choice. We can either have great wealth in the hands of very few people, or we can have a democracy. We cannot have both.
Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich.
Question your electoral assumptions.
It's a philosophical election special.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our program comes to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We continue conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
Today, it's a special edition of Philosophy Talk. We're looking beyond the horse race, asking some of the philosophical questions raised by this year's presidential election.
Trump and Clinton dominate the headlines, in part because the Republican and Democratic parties dominate our government, which leaves a lot of people wishing they had more viable third-party options. So why do we have the two-party system we do? We'll talk with Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution.
In a democracy, you do end up with something that a lot of people don't like because you have to make compromises.
Now, some of the dissatisfaction with the major party nominees also stems from the influence of money on every aspect of the campaign and politics in general. We'll examine the role of money in politics with former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich.
If we are free and equal citizens, we actually should have an equal opportunity to influence political debate.
Now, what if you're so dissatisfied with the candidates that you wonder if you should vote at all? Well, you'd be in good company. The U.S. has some of the lowest voter participation in the world.
We'll be joined in just a bit by Stanford political scientist Emily Chapman. We'll ask her whether voting is a choice or a duty.
First, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to put that question to potential voters. She files this report.
And I come to ask you to go all out, to get every Negro in this county registered to vote.
Martin Luther King Jr. delivered this speech in South Carolina in 1966.
For this is the way we are going to straighten up the South and the nation.
He told his African-American audience to head to the polls and create positive change for their community and their country.
Freedom and dignity for their spirits, education and culture for their minds. Let us march on ballot boxes.
If your vote doesn't count to begin with, why do you vote? Why should you vote?
Not everyone thinks voting is the way to go.
I do not vote. Partially because living in California, I figure the presidential election is pretty much decided anyway. Not like we're in a swing state.
I don't feel that voting is not going to have an impact on the inherent violence and corruption in the system.
I feel like if I did vote, it would be more for my own sort of self-validation of feeling like I was contributing when it probably wouldn't actually make a difference.
Many argue there's no point in voting because we have a two-party system that limits chances of any true democracy. In fact, our founding father, George Washington, thought all political parties sucked. In his farewell address of 1796, he wrote,
"The alternate domination of one faction over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge, natural to party dissension, is itself a frightful despotism."
And then there's money. There's a lot of it in politics. According to Open Secrets, 3 months before the 2016 presidential elections, Hillary Clinton had received over $430 million in campaign contributions, over half of them from corporations. Our two-party, money-loving political system is flawed, but we still have a moral obligation to vote, right?
people keep pushing for this line that, like, if you don't vote, it's shameful and blameworthy.
Jason Brennan is professor of strategy, economics, ethics, and public policy at Georgetown University, and the author of The Ethics of Voting.
I don't really feel like you need to be told you're a bad person if you don't vote to get you to the polls.
Brennan says people can practice their civic duty by writing letters to the editor, working as doctors or plumbers, or any productive job that contributes to the social good.
You could do many, many other things, and it's not clear why voting is special.
He says even if people have a narrow conception of civic virtue, where being a good member of society is simply engaging in politics, it's still not clear why you have to vote.
So suppose it turned out Obama had, like, never voted. It'd be weird to go up to him and say, well, I guess you don't have civic virtue, you failed. He would be able to reasonably say, no, I exercise and exhibit civic virtue through other means other than voting.
Brennan says if you do decide to vote, then you are morally obligated to study up on the facts. Know your politics, know your history, know your candidates. And if you don't know, don't go to the ballot box.
You have an obligation to be a good voter in the same way that you're not obligated to become a parent, but if you do decide to become a parent, you should be a good parent.
Georgetown's Jason Brennan does vote in presidential elections. Not because he thinks he's morally obligated to do so, but because he believes it's one of many ways he can be civically virtuous. But Brennan could just as easily go write a letter to an editor. In fact, you can write us a letter about this episode by emailing comments@philosophytalk.org. I'm Shuka Kalantari, and I approve this message.
Thanks, Shuka, for that input from potential voters and potential non-voters. I'm John Perry, and with me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And you're listening to our Philosophical Election Special. We're joined now by Emily Chapman. She's a professor of political science from Stanford University. She's author of Voting Matters, a critical examination and defense of democracy's central practice. Emily, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
Well, we're very happy to have you. But now, you believe that I and everyone else in America or any democracy has a duty to vote. Tell me why you think that.
Right. So I think there are two steps in explaining what the argument is for a duty to vote. So the first is understanding why we have an obligation to participate in politics. And the second is understanding why we have an obligation to vote in particular. So there are a number of reasons, I think, for why participating in politics is really important. One is that we just have these obligations to contribute to certain kinds of goods that can only be provided collectively. A government that is capable of protecting basic human rights is one such thing. Another reason that we have for participating in politics is that we already benefit from and contribute to government policies in all kinds of ways. So we benefit from regulation of markets, from education, from provision of healthcare, and we contribute to these policies as well and these exercises of government power through paying taxes and lending a kind of moral authority because the state sort of purports to act in our name. And so it's really important morally for us to make sure that when the state acts in our name, that it's done in a just way.
So I'm a citizen, okay? And I don't feel like either of these candidates speaks to me. And I feel like I'm going to abstain, basically. And you're telling me I have a duty not to abstain?
Yes, I am.
Why?
Well, first of all, Trump and Clinton are not the only candidates in the race. So there are third-party candidates on the ballot in most states. And many states also allow for write-in options. So what I'm saying is that you have an obligation to participate in the decision, not necessarily that you have a duty to vote for Trump or Clinton. Beyond that, there are also many other offices and questions that will be on the ballot in different states. So everyone will have an opportunity to vote for a congressman come November. Many states will be voting for senator, as well as many sort of state and local offices, and in some states, ballot measures, initiatives. So we tend to focus a lot on the presidential election, and people sort of think, well, I've got nothing to say there. But there are many other decisions that are being made that are very consequential and that people should participate in.
But Emily, the most I can get out of your arguments is that it's a good thing if lots of people vote. But let me put forward an argument pertaining, let's say, just to me. So I'm a citizen of California. There's 35 million other citizens, probably a third, a half of them eligible to vote. Statistically, one person voting in California has no effect on the Senate, no effect on the presidency. I'm a resident of the Bay Area, and I'm a Democrat, so overwhelmingly, what I favor will be passed or not passed independently of me. If it, you know, if most of the Democrats in the Bay Area like it, fine. So it seems to me if it requires any effort or money, it's irrational for me to vote. Now, it's probably good for me to say that I voted and encourage other people to vote and maybe even claim it's a duty to vote. But I don't really see that it is a duty to vote or that it's even rational.
Right. So I think a lot of people have this concern that their vote is not going to change the outcome of the election. But one of the things that's really important about elections is that they play a special role in our democracy and the way that they structure our public political culture. And they can really only do this if the vast majority of people vote. So it's really important, even if your vote doesn't change the outcome, that you contribute to this sort of experience of mass participation. Because everyone thinks that they want to participate in politics, but they're not really sure where or when or how. But elections kind of provide this moment where we think, gosh, compared to every other form of participation, there is a widespread expectation that people will vote. And it's much clearer than sort of trying to figure out, well, what are we going to do? We're going to protest on this day, and how is that going to influence policy? So we know what's going to happen with elections. And so it can provide this really important coordinating role. And what I'm trying to say is that, you know, low turnout is a really bad thing, precisely because it sort of diminishes the coordinating role that elections can play, and also the role that elections play in socializing people into politics. So a lot of people stay home not because they sort of don't think that voting is a particularly good way to use their political voice, but rather just because they don't think of themselves as political agents at all.
But, you know, I have heard people say, you know, American, some elements of the American electorate are so uninformed and so disengaged that it's better that they not vote because, you know, they're not. Democracy assumes an informed electorate. And if you have an uninformed electorate.
So that might lead to a paradox this year where one of our presidential candidates is not qualified to vote.
Well, now. So, I mean, what do you think about that kind of thinking? Does that have any place in a democratic polity? I mean, there's something behind it. I don't know.
Right. So we certainly want people to be informed when they vote. I think, you know, there's two things to say about that. So one is thinking about what the standard would be for when someone is informed enough to vote is very difficult because differences in people's interests and frames of reference and perspectives often track education in important ways. And so if we were to try and exclude people who didn't know certain facts about politics, I think we'd be excluding really important viewpoints from our political system. But maybe we want to think not about excluding people, but about whether individuals who are not informed should stay home.
Yeah, right.
And I think that really is just getting the question backwards. So if, say, my husband were to come to me and say, look, I don't really know anything about cleaning or cooking. if I were to try and take care on some of the housework, I'd probably start a fire or break the vacuum. If he said that to me, I would have legitimate cause for complaint. He's really getting something backwards there. So generally, we decide what it is that we have obligations to do first and then sort of take steps so that we can fulfill them responsibly.
So I'm going to make you czar of American election laws. And you get to do anything you want because we vote. I mean, you say citizens of a democracy have a duty to vote. So Americans are in massive violation of their duty because we vote less than many other democracies, far less. Okay, you're going to change America. What are you going to do to improve our elections and improve our participation?
So the first thing I would do would be to make Election Day a national holiday. I think that not only lowers some of the barriers to participation, but it also gives people a more positive reason to vote because it sort of suggests this sort of public element of celebration around elections rather than just thinking of it as something really private that you do, just like filling out any other kind of form.
Okay, that's the first thing you do. Is there more?
We'll give you three things.
Yeah, so voter registration, making voter registration automatic and having a consistent and up-to-date and efficient method for seeing who's on the voter rolls, I think would be very important. And that would be absolutely necessary for following through with the third thing I would do, which would be to make voting compulsory with a system similar to Australia's.
$20 fine?
Yes.
Okay, well.
Australian dollars or American dollars?
American dollars.
So thanks a lot, Emily. This has been I'm going to vote, but I always vote. And I hope some of our listeners out there who might be sitting on the fence will be convinced to vote for somebody or something.
Thanks very much. I hope so, too.
Emily Chapman from Stanford University and her thoughts on the duty to vote. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're taking a philosophical look at the 2016 election.
Corporate campaign spending, independent super PACs, self-funded billionaire candidates. How did it get so expensive to run for office? Can our democracy survive the amount of money in our elections? We'll ask former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich.
Money, politics, and the future of democracy when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. It's our 2016 election special. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're taking a philosophical look at some of the big ideas raised by this year's presidential campaign.
Up next, it sure takes a lot of money to run for office these days.
I don't need anybody's money. I'm using my own money. I'm not using the lobbyists. I'm not using donors. I don't care. I'm really rich.
This campaign changes everything we've ever thought or known about money in politics.
There is a reason why these people are putting huge amounts of money into our political system.
If you've got something to say, say it directly. But you will not find that I ever changed a view or a vote because of any donation that I ever received.
They are throwing money at her because they have total control over every single thing she does. She is their puppet, and they pull the strings.
We're joined now by Robert Reich. He was the Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton. Now he's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of Saving Capitalism, For the Many, Not the Few.
Bob, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much, Ken and John.
I know you feel strongly about this topic that we want to talk to you about, the influence of money in politics. And I'm particularly concerned with the question of whether all this money in politics is really consistent with a thriving democracy. I fear that it is not. I wonder what you think.
It definitely is not. And this is not a new issue. Years ago, really at the tail end of the first Gilded Age, when economic power was concentrated and wealth was concentrated in a very few hands, the eminent jurist Louis Brandeis said, and I can only paraphrase him, we have a choice. We can either have great wealth in the hands of a very few people, or we can have a democracy. We cannot have both.
So let's distinguish economic equality and inequality from political equality and inequality. I mean, I would think that democracy, as part of its foundational thing, is committed to equal access to the means of political participation independently of wealth. That's a principle of democracy. Equality of income, that's a good thing, but I don't know if that's a foundational. Some degree of equality of income or equality of opportunity is foundational to democracy. But can't you at least conceptually, can't you have equal access to the means of political participation through regulations of various kind without necessarily solving the distributional problem about how should we distribute wealth?
Well, theoretically, you can. The Supreme Court, though, in a series of decisions, has decided that, number one, money is the equivalent of speech. Now, that was in a case called Buckley against Valeo. Once you decide that money is the equivalent of speech and you have a free speech First Amendment part of the Constitution, then that almost by definition gives people with a lot of money. And again, we're not talking about just garden variety of inequality here. We're talking about wide inequality. We're talking you give people with a lot of money special access. It's no longer equal access to the means of political participation. And then, secondly, the Supreme Court in Citizens United against the Federal Election Commission decides that corporations are people under the First Amendment. So put those two concepts together. Money is speech, corporations are people under the First Amendment, and it's no longer equal access to the means of political participation.
John Rawls, whom I admire, had this, what he called the difference principle to account for the inequality. He said, it's okay for people to have more than others as long as they're having more contributes to the overall goodness of life for everyone,
to the least well off.
Yeah, to the least well off. So I would modify Rawls in terms of realism and say, okay, they can have twice as much as they need to contribute to the less well off. Has America ever come close to the difference principle?
Well, it's interesting. Rawls also, along with that difference principle, posited a veil of ignorance, so that in coming up with what we might think of as the best set of rules and the most perfect system with regard to distribution of income, we would say, well, we don't know where we'll come out. We have a veil of ignorance over how we would do under those rules, but they appear to be fair to us notwithstanding. That fairness is a kind of a matter of what would be good for the system as a whole. So that in the 1950s and 60s, as we moved toward a much more egalitarian society than we had before, I think we came close to the Rawlsian difference principle or the veil of ignorance principle. Starting in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I think we diverged from that. Most people, when asked, for example, in a variety of polls, not just a single poll, but actually this has been repeated over and over again, what do you think the current distribution of wealth is in the United States and what should it be? They come up with fairly consistent ideas, but then when they're shown what it actually is, almost everybody is surprised, because what it actually is so much more concentrated than what they believe it is or what they think it should be.
I gotcha, and that's kind of depressing. But since I'm a philosopher and I'm a little pernicious, I mean, the money is speech idea. I get why some people, especially when it's applied to corporation, I get why some people are question that. But there seems a kind of reasonable thought there. Look, if I want to advocate for something, me, Ken Taylor, I want to advocate for something, and I want to advocate for it on the public airways and all that sort of stuff, and I buy the time to advocate for it, and the government were to come along and say, no, you can't do that, Ken. You cannot spend your hard-earned money to advocate for, I don't know, the end of the prison industrial complex. I'd say, government, where do you get off telling me how much I can spend of my own hard-earned money to advocate for things that I believe in? Isn't this a democracy? So, I mean, is it an odd thought that money is speech?
No, it's not an odd thought at all, and you put your finger exactly on the Supreme Court's logic. The problem is that when you have as much concentration of income and wealth as we now have, then the doctrine of money is speech and also corporations or people becomes pernicious. Then it starts undermining democracy. In other words, if we had the degree of inequality we had in the, let's say, 1950s, 1960s, even 1970s, then the Supreme Court's decision that money is speech wouldn't really be a major problem for democracy. When we get to the kind of inequality we have today, it is a major problem.
You're listening to Philosophy Talks 2016 Election Special. We're talking to former Labor Secretary Robert Reich about money and democracy.
When I look at the life of an average congressman today, I sometimes think, well, maybe we're focusing too much on the money givers and not the money receivers. I don't know why a congressman shouldn't be required to spend his working day in Congress and shouldn't be prohibited. This doesn't have to do with freedom of speech. It has to do with controlling one's employees from soliciting money, except under various, I mean, apparently most congressmen now spend half of the week, half of their working week soliciting money. That's just crazy. It ought to be illegal.
I tend to agree with you. Another possibility is to eliminate the quid from the quo. That is, anybody can contribute as much money as they want to a member of Congress, if we're talking only about members of Congress. But the members of Congress, that all goes into a kind of a blind trust kind of vehicle, and the member will never know and must never know under penalty of law who contributed what. Well, if you get rid of the quid pro quo, then the congressman is not going to be able to court the big money, because he's not going to know exactly where the big money is coming from, and the big money is not going to get the benefit of that big money.
Let me try something else, though. I don't want to sound pernicious, but I'm looking for principles on the other side of this, because I don't want us to all just be in happy agreement. I suppose somebody could say, look, quid pro quo corruption, I give you a bunch of campaign money and you do something, that's bad. And the structure of democracy should prohibit that. But speech, and the more speech, the better, and the more speakers, the better. So corporations... Obviously, corporations have maybe they're not people, they're not full persons, but they can speak. That is, they have opinions, they have interests, they can express this, they can advocate for their opinions. The more speakers, the merrier. Money speech costs money, so the more it's not, it's still one person, one vote. I mean, you're the consumer of my speech, and you get to decide. So why should the government? What interest does the government have in any way restricting anybody's speech on behalf of whatever? The government may have an interest in restricting, you know, bad bargains. I give you $1 million, you pass my legislation, but me advocating for whatever, free trade or whatever, why should the government have any role in restricting that speech whatsoever?
Well, the fallacy, the fallacy in that argument is the notion that there is more speech as a result of more money. Actually, it turns out that there's less speech, because most of us who don't have very much money, in fact, most of us who are not going to use vast fortunes to monopolize the airwaves, are disenfranchised. Our speech and our capacity to actually be heard is lessened because those airwaves are dominated by people who have a great deal of money, or corporations, or Wall Street. And it is not just the campaign contributions and the lobbyists. It's also the financing of these big think tanks and the experts and the experts who testify and basically are being paid to agree with the people who feed them, who give them the money to begin with.
So, okay, I think there's a principle I tried to articulate, and I think you're articulating a counter principle. If we're free and equal citizens and joint decision makers in a democracy, then we should have something like equal opportunity to influence political debate independently of our financial means. Otherwise, we're not standing as free and equal citizens. So there's a kind of argument from democratic principles to restrict the influence of money.
I think that's exactly right. And the Supreme Court has struggled with this. The notion that if we are free and equal citizens, we actually should have an equal opportunity. And this is the key, the equal opportunity to influence political debate. And what has happened is we no longer have an equal opportunity to influence political debate because of the extraordinary impact of big money.
Let me ask you, though, again, let's get this to a more philosophical plane about the two parties. I mean, Citizens United was against what was probably known as McCain-Feingold. That was a bipartisan thing. I know some Republicans objected to it from the beginning, but is there any reason, is there any real principled reasons why there should be a partisan divide on this issue? I mean, because both parties, you would think, are committed to democracy, to free and equal citizenship, to, fair competition among citizens are engaging in debate. Is there really any principled kind of political, philosophical reason rather than just sort of naked self-interest for the parties to be divided on this?
No. In fact, I think that most Americans, according to polls and according to what we've seen in the 2016 election, are adamantly opposed to what they call crony capitalism. They don't want there to be unrestricted big money in politics. And Republicans are as concerned about this as are Democrats. The reason we still have big money in politics is because there is already big money in politics that is preventing the parties from responding to what most people want.
Yeah, that's a depressing thought. But so maybe this election, I don't know. Is there any chance through this current electoral process for the people taking hold of their democracy? Do you see any hope for the people to take hold through this election or subsequent elections?
Well, you know, I'm always an optimist, and I think of it as a challenge. And if you want to be, I suppose, positive about it, you might say that in the 2016 election, this upsurge of populism, both this authoritarian populism on the right and the Bernie Sanders type political revolution, both, I think, have their origins in the bailout of Wall Street and the public's concern that capitalism has become crony capitalism and the big, big money is running the system.
Bob, this has been a great conversation. I'm really pleased to have you as our guest.
Okay, thanks very much, Ken. John, I enjoyed it.
Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich talking about money, politics, and the future of democracy.
You know what they say about money and politics?
No.
It's like water on pavement.
Why is it like water on pavement?
That's a good
one. Finds every crack and crevice.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our 2016 election special.
You know, Plato, one of the great philosophers of all time, one of the great political theorists of all time, thought that democracy was the second worst form of government. The only thing worse was tyranny. And here's the thing. He thought it was almost inevitable that democracy would devolve into tyranny because people would get so fed up with the noise of democracy that they would want a strong man to come along and be their hero and solve all the problems and have all the power. And, you know, I fear that we may be in such a moment in our own democracy.
Well, of course, one thing we're coping of, which Plato, as far as I can remember, doesn't mention, is the power of money to affect the election. I don't think they had the internet then. I guess if they had daily papers, somebody had to carve them out on a rock or something.
I think it took more than a day to carve it out. Yeah. So it probably couldn't have been daily.
Yeah. So there's this tremendous aspect of elections nowadays that I guess he would just say proves his point even more and makes it easier for the tyranny, not a tyranny of the sort he thought of, but tyranny of the rich, I guess.
One of the things he worried about deeply about democracy, and I think he was right, was that in democracy, public discourse is about manipulating the moods of this beast. He gives this metaphor of this beast with many moods, and the politician, and that beast with many moods is the people. And the politicians, the art of politics in a democracy, is learning what will arouse the beast, what will soothe the beast, what will put the beast to sleep. And if you look at the media and money and the manipulation of the public discourse, I think, again, Plato's onto something. And I think we're living in a moment in which the sort of corporate media, together with all the money, does just work, not to inform the beast, not to direct us toward the truth, but to manipulate the moods of the beast.
Well, of course, Plato, he thought there was tyranny, that was worse, democracy, that was second worst. His own recommendation was government by the wise, philosopher kings.
Yeah.
Our founding fathers tried to get a little of that in our system with the Senate, which they didn't see as being elected by the people. They saw being elected by electors from each state. And I think they thought for these six-year terms, they would pick wise and, thoughtful leaders. And the same for the Supreme Court. Well, I think there are a few justices that are wise. There are a few senators that are wise. But mostly, I'd say, our attempt to get some philosopher kings in there hasn't done too well either.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our 2016 election special.
Ken, here's a riddle for you. What do these three people have in common? Jill Stein, Gary Johnson, and Daryl Castle.
Johnson and Stein are running for president. I don't know the other one.
He's running for president, too. These are just three of the so-called third-party candidates. But why aren't their parties represented elsewhere in our government? What explains the overwhelming dominance of the two major parties in American politics?
Questioning our two-party system, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back. It's our 2016 election special. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're looking through a philosophical lens at some of the big issues in the 2016 presidential campaign. Right now, a closer look at our two-party system.
I want to win as the Republican. I want to run as the Republican nominee. Is there anyone on stage who is unwilling tonight to pledge your support to the eventual nominee of the Republican Party and pledge to not run an independent campaign against that person?
The Green Party presumptive nominee Jill Stein said this: Democratic Party elites have been caught red-handed sabotaging a grassroots campaign that tried to bring huge numbers of young people, independents, and non-voters into their party. Instead, they have shown exactly why America needs a new major party.
The lesser evil is a losing strategy because people stop coming out to vote for lesser evil politicians throwing them under the bus.
If you love our country, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
We're joined now by Elaine Kmark. She's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. She's author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you for having me.
Elaine, you've written and thought a lot about the two-party system. Let's start with the final verdict. Good thing or bad thing?
I don't think it's good or bad, because the way a party system evolves is a reflection of the underlying way a country chooses to organize its democracy. I think it's neutral, just as I think a multi-party system is also neutral. They each have their upsides and their downsides, and the fact is they come out of the structure of the democratic system that a country or a state chooses to use for itself.
So, but wait a minute, Lane. Let's slow down a little bit. It comes out of the structure of the system that a country uses for itself, chooses to use for itself. Our Constitution, which is our design for democracy,
right?
It doesn't mention parties anywhere. It doesn't mention any parties.
Of course not.
And indeed,
yeah,
our founding fathers thought partisanship would be the death of democracy and all that. So what are you talking about?
That's the point. Well, what I'm talking about is our Constitution established a House of Representatives, and we established single-member districts. And any country, as other countries have, that have single-member districts, it means that you elect one person from the district. If you elect one person from the district, it is very hard to divide that person, individual, into four or five different parties, depending on the votes.
That would be cruel and unusual punishment.
Yes, it most certainly would, and not to mention very confusing.
So let's jump ahead to today. There are a lot of people, not just a few, a lot of people who express deep dissatisfaction with a two-party system. They express deep resentment that they've got this limited choice and that they want a third party. They're hungry for a third party. It sounds to me like you're saying your message to those people, and not to put too fine a point of it on it, is get over it. Right? I mean, is that right?
Well, let me put it this way. There is nothing that keeps any American from forming a political party. There have been third parties in American history. But again, going back to the structure of the system, if you have winner-take-all districts, it means that it is very hard for a third party to get traction, because getting 20 or 25% of the vote just doesn't do anything for you. Whereas in a multi-party system or a multi-candidate district, you get 25% of the vote and you win 25% of the seats in the parliament. In those countries, a small party can grow. It can get some power in one election, do a good job in office, maybe become part of a majority governing coalition, and grow into the next election, right? In our system, in any one past the post system, it's really hard for a third party to get traction. That's why mostly what happens to third parties in American democracy is that they have gotten incorporated into one of the two major parties.
So when I was growing up, France was really in disarray. They couldn't get anything done, and we were told that's because they had so many different political parties, nobody really had any power. Then De Gaulle took over, and they did better. But now in America, we seem to have just two parties, but also nothing gets done. Congress can't do anything. Have we managed to have the worst of both worlds?
We are in a period of our history where not just the parties, but the voters are highly polarized. And the parties are simply reflecting what the voters are telling them. We are in a very highly polarized time, and at some point this will break. But remember, we've been through highly polarized times in our republic before. Maybe the most dramatic being, of course, the party system prior to the Civil War, where they never could resolve things, and they actually went to war over it. We were also highly polarized at the end of the 19th century. So we've been through a lot of periods of polarization in American politics, and they usually end by one party actually capturing a working majority and that's strong enough to A, get some things done, and B, cause an end to the polarization.
But one of the consequences of what you and John are talking about, now let's think about the nature of these two parties in a first-past-the-post single representative system versus a multi-party system with proportional representation. Those parties are going to be, it seems to me, because this is a big, complicated country.
Yep.
Those parties are going to seem to me highly kind of coalitional and somewhat ideologically diffuse, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they have to be. They are the proverbial big tent. For many years, Southern Democrats were very different from Northern Democrats, and New England Republicans were liberal and very different from Western Republicans. They've always been big tents, but they are also always evolving. In other words, there's nothing static about American political parties. They've always changed, and, you know, the party of Lincoln, the 1860 Republican Party that declared the Emancipation Proclamation, a lot of people at the Republican convention were wondering what happened to the party of Lincoln. Okay, they're always changing.
But see, I still want to go back to the current dissatisfaction with the two parties. I mean, the Tea Party found the Republican Party as then constituted highly unsatisfactory. The Sanders people find the Democratic Party highly unsatisfactory. Mm-hmm. Many people call themselves independent, though they still vote for one party or the other more or less consistently. Yep. I mean, it sounds like so you got these two parties, they're highly coalitional, but there's like bound to be dissatisfaction with them because of that. But it also sounds like your message to these folks who are highly dissatisfied is kind of, again, get with the program. What do you expect? You're living in a fantasy land if you think that there could be a pure party of the left a la Sanders or a pure party of the right a la the Tea Party.
Well, and look, I mean, I think you've put it in a sort of gloomy way. The fact of the matter is the Tea Party has really changed the Republican Party, and the Sanders candidacy has really changed the Democratic Party. They had an enormous impact on the Democratic platform. They got a platform that wouldn't have all looked like this had they not existed and done well. So you have dissatisfaction, but when the way we have change in American politics because of the underlying structure of the system is that the change comes through the political parties and by changing the nature of the coalitions in those parties.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This is our 2016 election special. We're talking with Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution about the two-party system.
So do other countries have, like, more than one person from the same congressional district?
Here's the simple way to understand this. If a country uses a multi-member districts, and then they use proportional representation, they tend to have more than two political parties. If a country's parliament or legislature is composed of single-member districts, then they tend to have two dominant parties, sometimes three, but basically two dominant parties. So take Great Britain or Canada. They have single-member districts, and they tend to have two, sometimes three or four, but mostly two parties. Take Israel or many of the Western European democracies. 21 out of 28 Western European democracies use proportional representation. So they have multi-parties. You know, every country has to decide how you're going to do democracy. And each method of, you know, assessing representation has its pluses and minuses.
So, Elaine, I'm going to give you a kind of a scenario here. So California finally secedes from the rest of the union, and it turns out there's no civil war because the rest of the union says good riddance. And so California hires you and a couple of other top-notch people to write a constitution. Which side are you going to come down on? Proportional representation for districts that will lead away from the two-party system, or something like the U.S. has now?
Well, interestingly enough, some countries have hybrid systems. How do you like that? Some countries have systems where it's winner take all at a district level or on a geographic level, and then it is proportional on a statewide level. So you can, in fact, mix these two systems up. And there's a certain attractiveness to mixing them up because you do get to reflect in the proportional system, you do get to reflect the strength of smaller factional parties, but you still have a system that's leading you towards a majority and towards majority rule. So not only can you pick winner-take-all or pick proportional, you could actually create a hybrid system. The bottom line is that there are pros and cons of all of these systems. They all are ways of legitimately reflecting people's preferences. And, you know, a lot of times it's just history and preferences as to which system they have. In parliamentary democracies, you know, they're always complaining because they look at our system and they think our system's better. We look at their systems, think their system's better. The fact of the matter is that you have to choose some way to reflect people's preferences in a democratic system. And they all have their pluses and minuses.
Okay, on that note, this has been a great conversation. Thanks so much, Elaine.
No, oh, thank you.
Politics is not real wisdom. It's hostile two-party system. Yeah.
Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution and her thoughts on America's two-party system. We invite you to continue thinking philosophically about this year's election at our online community of thinkers at Philosopher's Corner, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore I blog.
And you can also become a partner in that community at our website, philosophytalk.org. And even though we're not running for office, we still need your support to continue producing thought-provoking programs like this one. Please consider a donation to help keep Philosophy Talk on the air and online.
Now, how fast will this guy fill out his ballot? It's Ian Scholz, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholz, in August, Hillary Clinton gave a speech accusing Trump of merging his campaign with the alt-right. This is pretty shrewd. She didn't diss Republicans, just the fringe that made him a candidate. Still, she is Hillary and the most divisive political figure you can find, unless you're finding Donald Trump. The point is, if she calls something out, sizable amounts of people will naturally flock to it. So what is alt-right? It's an umbrella term. White supremacists, Nazis, white identitarians, who are different from white supremacists. They fear people of color for entirely different reasons. You have racists who brood in their hovels, racists who are active on Twitter, and more. You have men who didn't used to be political, but they want to put a stop to social justice warriors, who are women who want to stop us from watching sweaty men having sword fights on distant planets, gamergators. They're alt-right. And elements of the chat forum 4chan, the hackers called Anonymous. Trump has engaged some of the staff from Breitbart, an online publication that used to despise all media, but now has become what it despised, including the alt-right writer Milo Yiannopoulos, who is just banned from Twitter for life for horrible things he and his followers posted about black actress Leslie Jones, because She was in Ghostbusters, I guess. Some have laid a link between the alt-right and paleoconservative isolationist Pat Buchanan, who stewed so long in his own bile he boiled away to nothing. Peter Thiel, the wealthy libertarian who funded the lawsuit behind the scenes that brought down the snarky online blog Gawker, is identified with the alt-right movement, if you can call it that, which is also anti-democratic, anti-utopian, and believes we should run things like a business. Put Elon Musk in charge and stand back. I mentioned nasty Twitter attacks on people they don't like, but they've also doxxed people they don't like. That is, posted their personal information online so people can throw foul insults and death threats at them. They've even photoshopped their heads and bodies from bad porn movies and post that online for the lulz, for the fun of it. There's not really a religious bent to the alt-right, though some are pro-monarchy and pro-dictator and put an apocalyptic spin on their nasty little trolls. They're like Nazi yippies, some of them, but if they dress like Nazis, they're only LARPing, play-acting, because SS uniforms are cool. Get over yourself. Lighten up. There's a steampunk thing going on, I think. Weird porn involving tentacles and dead teenagers. Don't even like to think about it. So don't worry, it's fringy cult stuff, like hippies, only sociopathic. The manosphere, men's rights advocates, last straw ranters, being a males, proud possessors of a toxic masculinity, all in that rich alt-right stew. Psycho Peter Pan punk rockers with poor people skills. Came out of the Tea Party, too, I guess. Once poor people got mortgages, it ruined everything. Now, if Trump loses, this might all blow over. Or the seeds might have been sown. 4 years, eight, we will elect chubby and sadistic gamers to national offices. Surrounded by their fit goons and the women who please them, they better if they want to keep living. Oh, and Ann Coulter, of course, she comes with the package. Kind of a fascist scenario, isn't it? Don't mean to alarm you, but maybe that's what we want. Cute hipster gangsters will keep things running at home, hi Uber, as their underpaid armies do battle with ragtag zealots driving news pickups in a desert superheated by global warming. I can't wait. Gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave McAllister is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Mark Stone, Erica Topete, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And also from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.